Good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Saturday, March 21st, 2020, and the time is 9 a.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha Von Imhoff, and I'm joined today by Senator Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski. We also have Senator Keel, Senator Coghill, Senator Rivak, Senator Stevens, and Senator Giesel joining us today. We have a quorum to do business. So I'd like to start off with thanking everyone for being here today on a Saturday morning. As you know, we normally don't meet on Saturdays, let alone a Saturday in March. But as you are all aware, we are in unprecedented times. We cannot delay. We are watching this virus run over New York, LA, and Seattle hospitals. We are reading about communities shutting down one after another, asking people to stay in their homes. Businesses are laying off workers and closing their doors. People are not traveling. Kids are not in school. This coronavirus is hitting us in two ways. First, it's an acute health and medical emergency causing life-threatening respiratory infection in some people. Second, the economic impacts are also severe, and there will be long-lasting effects for months or even years to come. Our goal here today is to explore what programs and assets we already have in place so we can leverage our existing infrastructure, both public and private, in order to support Alaskans as quickly and efficiently as possible. We invited several folks to testify today in the areas of housing, unemployment benefits, small business support, food insecurity, connectivity, and the supply chain. We want to ensure Alaskans that we are working on a plan and we have the infrastructure in place that is sufficiently funded to provide the needed resources to help people immediately during this difficult time. The legislature is looking at enhanced employment, unemployment benefits, mortgage assistance, food aid, interest-free loans, expanded child care and health care services, and direct aid to communities, and more. Already in the supplemental budget, the legislature appropriated nearly $20 million in state funds specifically towards health care to help Dr. Ann Zink in her gallant efforts. We are also closely watching what the federal government is doing, and we are seeing a large COVID-19 omnibus bills pass, several of them, with significant bipartisan support to provide immediate cash assistance to both individuals and businesses as part of a comprehensive economic plan. For Alaska, it is imperative that we have laser focus on our state accounts and various funds so that we can direct our scarce and dwindling resources towards the greatest impact. It is also important that we utilize federal funds as much as possible and avoid potential redundancies to make sure that we maximize all funding and ensure our state agencies are ready and poised to receive the money and use it wisely with the broadest benefit. Alaska is experiencing a perfect storm, a most terrible trifecta, the hat trick from hell. We are being hit on all sides with the stock market crash, oil prices plummeting, and the tourism and fishing season all but idle. Alaskans should rest assured that we, the legislature, are taking action. A bipartisan group of legislators is putting a plan in place. We are working days, evenings, and weekends, and Alaskans are our priority. We cannot afford to wait, and in addition, any plan we put in place cannot exploit a pandemic to further any political agenda. Hardworking men and women who, through no fault of their own, are struggling to pay bills and put food on the table, we will provide the helping hand. With that, I'd like to start our presentation. First up, we have Alaska Housing. Actually, what we'll do, I'll back up again. We have about 5 minutes. We're going to start Alaska Housing at 10 after 9. I want to state on the record that Senator Wilson is here with us. For 5 minutes, is there anybody at this table who would like to make a quick comment, a moment or two, before we begin? Senator Bishop.
I would just like to permission, a question from the chair. I usually like to close with some comments. Well, I would just like to save my time for the end.
If that's, for the end?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Senator Stedman.
Madam Chairman, just for the public watching, there's clearly an expedited process we're going through here in the legislature. We have substantially constrained savings accounts compared to the last several years, so we're trying not to replicate anything the federal government is doing, and that we are an additive to it. So just for the public, just to kind of keep that in mind as we look at unemployment benefits, housing issues, we have a lot of agencies in the state already with some structure that can help. So we're putting this mosaic together, and it'll be coming together in just a handful of days, literally. I hope two or three and we're done.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman, for joining us. So as listeners or as invited testimonies on the phone, what we're hoping is that each agency can state on the record what is it that you're doing during this time and what can the state do to help you with your efforts. If you could all address this as you go through the invited testimony, it will help us define legislatively, particularly and potentially financially, what we can do on our end these next few days. So first up, we have Brian Butcher with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. So Mr. Butcher and Stacy Barnes, please proceed. Whenever you're ready, and we have you until about 9:30.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Butcher, CEO, Executive Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I would like to touch on the housing market as a whole, our public housing, and then also homelessness. Starting out with the housing market, we are fortunate in Alaska as we go into this public health crisis that has created a fiscal crisis in that the strength of our housing market, even after having 5 years of a recession here in Alaska, has been very strong. Our delinquency rates of our portfolio of 16,000 mortgages is under 3%, which is almost at a historical low in our 49-year history. Our foreclosure rates are under a quarter of 1%. Again, that might be the lowest in our 49-year history. We don't have the majority of the mortgages in the state, and I believe the state numbers are slightly higher, but still very low. Low compared to Alaska history, low compared to other states. We've also benefited by having very low interest rates, and that's the difference between now and 08-09. Interest rates weren't sky high in 08-09 like they were in the 80s, but they were higher than they are now. And so most people have been able to refinance their mortgages into very low 3%, 3.5%. Some a couple of weeks ago even got into the 2.75, 2.875. So that gives home owners a lot more flexibility in terms of the funds that they have to run their household than they would if we saw higher interest rates. That being said, we are looking at potential how we're going to handle those numbers coming up. As I'm sure you're aware, the governor had an executive order yesterday that announced a moratorium on foreclosures and evictions in housing for HFC for corona-related viruses, which are basically homeowners that have difficulties with reduced income, loss of jobs, medical expenses, anything that is connected to this crisis. We worked with the governor on this. We believe it was a good step to allow Alaskans to understand that they can move forward and deal with the situations they're dealing with in this crisis and not have to worry about being foreclosed on or being evicted from the homes in which they live. And I'm happy to respond to questions there, or I can continue with the rest of the presentation.
So I'm looking at my committee members right now. Please continue.
Okay. Moving on to public housing, we have HFC runs over 1,600 apartments in 13 different communities. We administer 5,000 to 6,000 vouchers to Alaskans. These are vouchers that Alaskans get from us, and they go to private sector landlords. These programs are federally funded through HUD. We receive $60 million approximately a year to run these, and we see an average of $3 million a month going out of AHFC to private landlords and vouchers. These are folks that we're concerned about. I think when you begin to talk about layoffs, you look first at Alaskans that are living paycheck to paycheck, and this tends to be the lower income individuals that are in our housing. As an example, over 80% of the 12,000 Alaskans that are in our housing are at 30% of median income and under. So these are Alaskans that if they didn't have help with housing, they would be homeless or near homeless. And so this, I believe, is the most vulnerable population, certainly on the front end of this crisis. The governor also had an executive order yesterday in working with us that put a moratorium of 60 days for evictions. Again, for corona-related issues, there will be no evictions moving forward. So the folks in our public housing units and the folks that have vouchers that are renting from private sector landlords do not have to worry about potential losing their housing. They can focus on the other issues, food and the other staple issues that they need to focus on to continue life as we move through this crisis. And then the last topic, Madam Chair, has to do with the homeless assistance program. And once again, as we deal and look at people that have been living paycheck to paycheck, it doesn't take a lot to move them from a situation where they're getting by to a situation of potential homelessness. We have a lot to thank the legislature and the governor for the early passage of the mental health bill, because the homeless assistance program and the special needs housing program that work in concert to deal with the homeless have been funded early. And I know some of you are aware that the way the homeless assistance program is administered by AHFC is when we work with the shelters, they sign 3-year contracts with us. And the reason for that is it's very difficult to have a nonprofit survive with the expectation that the funding may go away in a year. So it's in the capital part of the mental health bill. We administer it over 3 years. And when the mental health capital bill passed early, that gave us the flexibility to use some of the funds that would have rolled out in 21 in FY20. So we executed grants to our providers, 41 providers in 13 different communities, to be able to access the funds early to administer between FY20 and FY21, because we expect in the fourth quarter of FY20 to potentially see a spike in the number of people that need the services. And then they're also able to use those funds over FY21, so they can smooth them out to make sure they're manage it, not just for the end of the current fiscal year, but into FY21. So those are the big picture areas that we have the most concern about.
Thank you, Mr. Butcher. I'd also like to point out that we had dropped a bill, an operating budget, last night on the table here in Senate Finance that included full funding for AHFC and all the different programs.
Yeah, that's very much appreciated, Madam Chair. And I'd like to point out specifically, as part of our homeless assistance program, is a homeless prevention program. And that program works to stop people that are near homelessness to fall into homelessness. Studies show that it's about 4 times less expensive to keep a family in a home than it is to have to take a family out of homelessness and put them in a home. We see the average cost of helping somebody avoid homelessness as about $500 an Alaskan. So that's something we're also very much focused on, because, as I mentioned before, we see the possibilities of a large number of Alaskans potentially being close to homelessness, and we want to make sure that we prioritize this program to make sure, if at all possible, they don't move into homelessness in the first place.
Yes, so thank you. Before I go with Senator Wilson here, that's actually one of the questions I want to ask you, is just make sure who people right now who are not current AHFC program participants but are close to it. Just want to make sure that they can get the help that they receive, and it sounds like they can turn to you. Is that correct?
In the different programs, if you're talking about the homeless assistance program, they would reach out to the shelters. And then the shelters would then talk to us. If we look as if we need increased funds, that would then work up to us. But we are not the boots on the ground. It would be the shelters that they would contact. Just like if an Alaskan's having an issue with their mortgage, they feel like they've lost their job, they have concerns on if they're going to be able to make their mortgage payment, they would contact their servicer. Their servicer is who they make their mortgage payment to. The servicer would then work with us. And we would encourage Alaskans to contact them earlier rather than later. If you feel like there's going to be an issue, you need some help, or there needs to be a suspension or other potential tools we have, the sooner that the servicers and Alaska Housing knows, the better.
Thank you, Brian. So we have Senator Wilson has a question.
Yes, thank you, Director Butcher. How are you handling mortgages in process? Are those still going through as normal? If people have a time to withdraw, if they're a little concerned about that, what's currently being done with that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's actually a great question, because a lot of the stress we've been dealing with in the last week has had to do with that. We are still offering an interest rate. Potential homeowners are still able to lock in. However, that interest rate has gone higher and higher almost by the day. And the reason for that is we saw interest rates drop below 3% last week when the Fed dropped their numbers to zero. However, what we're finding out is that the banks and the mortgage companies and the credit unions that are the ones that make the loan, and then either we or Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac purchase the loan, they're finding they're unable to sell the loan. And so Fannie and Freddie aren't buying. We're kind of been the only game in town. And again, our interest rates fluctuate based on what the cost of capital is. I know I'm getting into more detail than you probably need, but right now the capital markets, there's no liquidity. We couldn't sell a bond if we needed to. And so as our funds get lower and lower, if things stay the way they are over this last week, we're not going to have the option to access Wall Street for capital through the bond market. So we're still seeing the mortgage. There's still mortgages being done. There's still people locking in, but it's shrinking by the day.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to play off Senator Wilson's question, I heard on public radio last night that existing Fannie and Freddie loans were going to be a 12-month moratorium on them if you couldn't make your payment. Have you got advisement on that?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I know the president put out an order for suspension on that. I don't believe it was that long. I believe off the top of my head it was 60 days or 90 days. But we'll get back to you on that. I think the thinking is similar to what we have been thinking, which is we're going to deal with the short term. If it gets near the end of the 60 days and it appears as if this is continuing, I'm sure conversations will go on with the governor to look at you know, extending that.
Senator Bishop, follow up.
Well, I'll let Senator Stedman go, but then I got a different line of question.
Well, just kind of a add on to the previous two questions. The rental market and all of the citizens around the state that rent their housing. My understanding is there will be no evictions for some period, 60 days or so. Do you know anything about that? And can you highlight that for the public?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Stedman, there is a 60-day moratorium for all of the public housing voucher holders that are in the close to 6,000 apartments across the state. However, that is not the majority of apartments. We do not run, nor do we have vouchers in the majority of apartments. So at this point, I don't know what the situation is with that. I've seen different governors in different states take a look at having a broader suspension on evictions. And some have found they have a lot of flexibility, and some have found that they haven't. We've had conversations with the governor's office about that, but I'm not an attorney, so I don't know specifically kind of where they are with that.
Do you have a follow-up, Senator Stemmen?
Just, Madam Chairman, I think that would be good information to get out to the public and clarification for us, because if this does go on beyond, if there is a moratorium for 60 days on evictions and we get into this exponential virus growing in the state, we may need to have to extend that. So we just need to be up to speed on that also.
Yeah, so Mr. Butcher, if you could come back to the committee with just, is it 60, is it 90 days, if you have any information on that moratorium. And before we go to back to Senator Bishop, the question that I have for you is, you do receive federal funds now. Are you poised and able then to receive additional funds, federal funds, when these omnibus bills are passed?
Madam Chair, yeah, we are poised to accept them. We certainly would have need for them. The question would be if we have federal appropriation authority. We certainly don't have excess federal appropriation authority if a substantial amount of federal funds come through. And for the benefit of the committee, the corporation has been used for a lot of federal emergency funds. As a good example, much if not most of the disaster relief funds that came through after the 1964 earthquake came through us. And I don't believe we have that number, but we also don't have a ballpark number on what we might need. So hopefully that would be possibly an OBNA request.
Yes, thank you for that information. I think that's the kind of information that we would need. And I think, and you did mention that you have liquidity now, at least for the foreseeable future. And I think the goal is for the federal government to get its portion out as soon as possible as well. Senator Bishop.
Mr. Butcher, how do you determine who qualifies for a rental voucher?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we have federal rules that we go by with HUD. They're different for whether you get into public housing or whether you get a voucher. It's a requirement of 50% of median income and below for the public housing and 80% of median income and below for vouchers. But there is a prioritization based on need. And so that's why, as I mentioned, even though somebody of a little higher income would qualify, they tend to, 80% tend to be very low income. And there is waiting lists in most communities, and they vary depending on the size of the family, because HUD restricts what size of apartments numbers of individuals can be put into. And we can certainly provide the committee with a list of our waiting lists by community if you'd like.
Follow up. Thank you, Matt. Mr. Butcher, Madam Chair, thank you. One just quick question. And when you provide that to the committee, the other question I had, and if you don't know, you don't have to answer right now, but is there people that are on unemployment, are they eligible as well to apply for this rental voucher? So thank you.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Bishop, they are.
Thank you.
So thank you. I think I also want to point out to the committee that we are we have a comprehensive list here today, housing being one, but there's more than one way to be able to pay for your rent. One of them is we're hearing now with Alaska Housing Finance Assistance, but we're also looking at wage replacement. So if we can try to provide wages to businesses to pay their employees, then they can continue as normal, and I put in quotes, normal here. So there's many different ways, and we're just looking at all the different options right now. So we have about 4 to 5 minutes with Mr. Butcher here. Do we have any other further questions about housing assistance? So the question I have for you is, aside from wage replacement, what it sounds to me is folks who are not already an AHFC program should either contact their banks if they have a mortgage, should you mentioned homeless shelters who will then turn around, both banks and homeless shelters will turn around and contact you. What our committee is going to try to do is get telephone numbers So we can put that maybe on the legislative website. We have your website up, Mr. Butcher. Do you have, staying on top of the coronavirus, are you putting, is this open, our public housing offices can be reached by phone. So you have phone, and so people can click on that and get your phone number. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have closed our offices to the public, so to restrict for public health reasons, but they can get to us through email, our website, or a 1-800 number.
And you have sufficient employees being able to handle that call volume?
At this point, we do, and I anticipate for the near future we will.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Butcher and Ms. Stacy Barnes, thank you both for calling in this morning. Our next subject is unemployment benefits. I apologize. Unemployment benefits. We have Ms. Patsy Westcott, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Labor. And we heard from Patsy before, but we're going to quiz you again. So thank you, Ms. Westcott, for being online this morning. What we want to reiterate is kind of much what we talked about already, but with you, with the unemployment bill that we had. But we'd like you to state again what resources you have in place now in terms of financial as well as employees being able to handle the volume. Are you poised to receive federal funding when it comes through? And then number three, what can the state do to help you with your efforts?
Well, good morning. Thank you, Chair Von Imhoff and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patsy Westcott. I'm the director of the Division of Employment and Training Services with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about Alaska's unemployment insurance program and what we can do in response to the conditions that we are faced with today. So just a little brief overview of the unemployment insurance program. It is an insurance program as opposed to a social service program, much like your car insurance. Employers pay premiums in the way of tax contributions into the program to protect against an employee's future loss of wages. And in Alaska, we are only one of three states that has provision in statute where the employee also pays a portion of the UI tax contributions. Currently, our maximum weekly benefit amount is $370. Alaska is also one of a handful of states that provides for a dependence allowance, which is currently at $24 per dependent per week and at a cap of three dependents. We have a couple different ways for filing for unemployment insurance. We have an online application through the My Alaska portal, and then we have a call center, a virtual call center, where folks that don't have internet access can call into our call center to file their initial claim for benefits. There are a couple of long-standing basic requirements to be eligible for unemployment insurance. One is that an individual be unemployed through no fault of their own. The second is that the individual be able, available, and actively seeking work. It is that second long-standing requirement that is presenting challenges for unemployed workers, given the current environment. And I'll speak more to that in just a few minutes. Some of the things that we are doing currently to address the influx of claims that we're already experiencing, we have stood up another queue within our virtual call center specifically for individuals that are calling in that have that are out of work because of COVID-19. We've expanded our phone hours. We are doing overtime. In fact, I have staff working today processing claims. We have realigned 28 staff that were working in other units of the unemployment insurance program to handle the claim workload that is coming in at this time. We have seen a significant sharp increase in the number of claims that are being filed from last week to this week. I don't have hard, firm numbers currently, but we're looking at 60 to 70% increase in the number of claims filed. We took a deep dive at our application this last week and put changes into production on Friday to simplify the application to make it easier for unemployed workers to get their claim filed. Going back to the able, available, and actively seeking work requirements, as you can imagine, overcoming that hurdle is difficult at this time for Alaskans, and so we are liberally applying our statutes and regulations at this time to allow as many individuals as possible. And we are grateful to the United States Department of Labor for coming out with additional guidance to states that allows states more flexibility in relaxing that requirement, providing that state law does the same. We have, so traditionally in Alaska, I've been with the program for 27 years, and traditionally in Alaska, when an individual files their initial claim, then after that initial filing, they file on a biweekly basis, so every 2 weeks, in order to get their benefits. We are working on programming changes so that individuals can file a single week at a time so that we can get benefits out the door faster. We've stood up a website, we're working on standing up a page on our department's website that is specifically related to COVID-19 with information for unemployed workers and for employers, actually. We've received a lot of inquiries from employers that are really trying to do right by their employees, and so they have questions about, you know, how to lay off their employees and make sure that those employees are eligible for benefits. So we're working on getting information specifically all on one page so that whether you're an employer or an employee, you can get out there and access everything that you need to know about filing for unemployment insurance. One of the things that would be very helpful is there are a couple of pieces of legislation before the Alaska legislature, that is House Bill 308 or the companion bill, Senate Bill 240. Both of these pieces of legislation would enable our program to even further liberally interpret the able, available, and actively seeking work requirement of the program so that we can pay even more individuals that are unemployed through no fault of their own. And they are available for work, but they can't actively seek work right now because businesses are closed. So the restaurant worker who is laid off can normally go to another restaurant and apply for a job, and that is simply not the case at this time. And so those pieces of legislation would allow us to really be able to address that problem more efficiently and expand eligibility. In addition, they provide for a larger dependents allowance, and they remove the cap of 3 dependents. So for those families that have more than 3 children, they would allow us to add extra dependents to someone's claim so that we can provide for those families during this time. It also removes the waiting week. So currently Alaska has what's called a waiting week, and so when an individual applies for unemployment insurance, the very first week of their unemployment is what's called a waiting week, and we can't pay benefits for that waiting week. And those pieces of legislation would remove the waiting week requirement so that we could actually pay that first week. And that's really crucial, especially now. So that's kind of where we're at, and the things that we have done to date, and I am available for any questions the committee may have.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Patsy. That was a very good comprehensive overview. If we can get 308 done, passed in the next 24 hours, I know you're programming right now. What I'm a little concerned, I want to get this done because I know you had 4,700 people or rounded last week that applied. This isn't law yet. Is there and I know you're programming your claim system, and I think time is of the essence, so these people don't have to call back and reapply again on this waiting week. So would that help you if we can get this done and the governor can get it signed in the next 24, 36 hours?
That absolutely, through the chair, Senator Bishop, that absolutely would help our program. The one caveat that I would have would be regarding the effective date of the legislative change. And so currently I think the legislation is written that the changes are effective immediately. Yep. For us to go back and to apply those changes retroactively, the effective date of the legislation would need to provide for that.
And just one follow-up, Madam Chair. Ms. Westcott, have you guys been thinking, I know you're already thinking it, but if you could help me, are we thinking about drafting another letter to the delegation, maybe about some additional just in the queue down the road? We've got a very healthy trust fund. I just want everybody to understand that. But we want to plan, be forward in our thinking and planning, a letter to the delegation for additional, maybe emergency grant UI funds like we encountered when in 2008.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I know that letters have already been submitted to Alaska's congressional delegation. I also know that I think it was H.R.
Yep.
Yeah, 6021, I think, that Congress passed and the president signed does have provision in it for additional administrative funding to the unemployment insurance program in direct response to COVID-19.
Thank you.
So on that, Ms. Westcott, just want to make sure, are you poised to receive federal funds when they are released?
Chair Von Einhoff, that is a very good question. I do think that the division currently, there is the potential conflict of not having enough federal authority for FY20. To accommodate the receipt of additional federal funds.
Okay, so thank you for that. So what it looks like, two things. We have this bill that you talked about us with this 308. It's in this committee now, so we're gonna work with our committee members to move it out, but it sounds like we may have to do a CS. With the CS, we may increase the federal receipt authority, as well as you mentioned that you'd like the effective date. Can you give us what you believe an effective date would help work for you? It would be the beginning of March, the second week of March. What would be work so we can get it ordered?
That is an excellent question, Chair Von Amhoff. And I guess my recommendation would be the beginning of March, the first week of March. That's when we started to see at that time, it was kind of a slight increase in claims load. That has certainly ramped up, especially this past week. But certainly the beginning of March would allow us the greatest flexibility in being able to really respond to the needs of unemployed Alaskans.
Okay, and so in the CS, if we increase the federal receipt authority as well, this will allow you then to receive the federal money when they're released?
Chair Von Ohmhoff, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Stedman, followed by Senator Wilikowski.
I think we could take a look at, we have several vehicles, I think, that could expand the receipt authority, so it may not necessarily be this vehicle. It takes appropriation bill, I think. But we can definitely be on point to make sure that the department has ample federal receipt authority, like we did Medicaid, to deal with whatever comes from Washington over the next several months. So we'll footnote that and make sure that that's taken care of.
I had Senator Wilikowski, unless you have a point on the, okay, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had asked the other day about comparison with other states, and I know you're busy. I haven't seen that yet, but I just looked it up on the Congressional Research Office, and at least last year it looks like, well, Alaska's is $370 max, and it looks like Oregon is $648 per week, Washington is $790 per week, Hawaii is $630 per week. If you look at oil-producing states, North Dakota, $618 a week, Texas, $507 a week, Oklahoma, $520 a week. It looks to me like ours is just woefully inadequate. Would you agree with that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, our maximum unemployment insurance weekly benefit amount is very low given the average weekly wage in the state of Alaska. I do remember your request for our for those charts. Those were sent up to our commissioner's office. My apologies that you have not received them yet. I know they're on their way to you. We are 37th in the country with regard to our maximum weekly benefit amount, and we are last in the country with regard to our what is called wage replacement rate. And the wage replacement rate looks at the average weekly benefit amount for the state as a percentage of the state's average weekly wage. And we are last. And that includes after Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands.
So, Ms. Westcott, did you say, though, that I thought I heard you say that in the Bill 308 there was a provision for a temporary higher amount for the weekly benefit? Is that correct?
Chair Von Ohmhoff, that is not correct. The bill does not include provision for increasing the weekly benefit amount. What it does do is it increases the dependence allowance from $24 a week to $75 a week per dependent, and it lifts the cap on the number of dependents that we can consider.
Okay, so is that then a potential avenue? I guess we've had a conversation with Senator Bishop. Is there a way to do a temporary higher amount for the weekly benefits? If so, do we need a statute? And if not, how would that look?
Chair Von Ohmhoff, yes, benefit amounts are set in statute, AS 232350. So it would require a statutory change in order to increase the maximum weekly benefit amount. And what that would look like is unknown at this time. I do know that at a congressional level, Congress is looking at so let me back up just a minute. Back in the recession, the 2008-2009 recession, Congress passed a number of pieces of legislation, and one of those pieces was called federal additional compensation. And what it did was it, for all states across the nation, regardless of what their weekly benefit amount was, it added a dollar amount to every payment that went out the door. And so I do know that Congress is looking at doing a similar provision now that would add to a state's weekly benefit amount in the form of additional compensation that would be 100% federally financed. I had to respond to USDOL yesterday with questions about that. What I don't know at this time is the amount that they are looking for or that they are looking at implementing, but I do know that it is something that is being looked at a national level.
Okay, at a national level. And we did increase, within the bill you mentioned earlier, the dependent issue by taking the lid off of that. So there is some wiggle room there. We have about 4 minutes left. Senator Wilikowski.
I'm just curious. I know there was some testimony the other day about we have a very significant balance in the OI trust. If we increase the minimum weekly benefit or the maximum weekly benefit, say $100 to $470, how much would that impact our trust, the trust fund?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't have an answer for you. That is certainly something that we can take a look at, that I can have our UI actuary take a look at. I know that he has already done some significant stress testing on our unemployment insurance trust fund, meaning that he has taken a number of different proposals and ideas and looked at what that would do to Alaska's trust fund if we were to implement those provisions. I know that our trust fund is extremely healthy at this time, and we are well poised to weather this storm that we find ourselves in today.
So we have just a couple minutes. We do, again, have this bill in front of us, and it's imperative that we move it out here quickly. As Ms. Westcott has stated, the number of applicants for unemployment insurance has increased dramatically. We do want to make sure that we provide benefits for people to help them get through this time, but we also don't want to overstress the accounts, and we also want to provide, we want to wait for the federal money to come in too, which hopefully should be soon. The next issue, or the next presenter, though, is the small business. Small business support, and ideally we want to have wage replacement for people and provide businesses loans so they can continue paying wages to alleviate the need to go to unemployment insurance. So it's all sorts of different tactics that we're looking at now. So Ms. Westcott, thank you very much for your invited testimony today. We really appreciate you calling in on a Saturday. Our next presenter is Mr. John Bittner with the Alaska Small Business Development Center, support for small businesses and avoiding business failure. So we have John Bittner, and we also have Joe Shearhorn, the CEO of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Is that it? Or he's with the Bankers Association. So we're going to start off with Mr. Bittner with Small Business Development Center. So Mr. Bittner, what we're asking presenters to do is to kind of discuss the resources that you have now to handle the increased volume and payout in terms of employees and cash resources. And number two, are you poised to receive federal funds when they are released? And then number three, what kind of things can the state do to help you? So, you know, the floor is yours for the next 10 minutes, and let's take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Bittner with the Alaska SBDC. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today. A quick overview of the SBDC, what we have currently in terms of resources. We've been helping small businesses in Alaska for the last 35 years. Just to clarify what that means in terms of what a small business is, they tend to be businesses under 500 employees. So as you can imagine, in Alaska, that represents a little over 99% of all the businesses in the state. We advise 1,600 to 1,700 clients in one-on-one advising sessions, confidential advising sessions, and we provide workshops and training to another 1,600 to 1,700 Alaskans every year. We provide services in over 100 communities, and we have physical locations in 7 centers across Alaska: Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, the Matsu, Soldotna, Seward, and Ketchikan. As you can imagine, and as the previous speakers have mentioned, small businesses are being hit particularly hard right now. AEDC, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, recently mentioned that they had released a survey to judge the impact of the COVID-19 virus on businesses. They've received over 500 responses. 90% of the people, the businesses surveyed, said that they had been negatively impacted. What we're seeing in our clients, we've like I mentioned, seen a significant upswing in the number of businesses contacting us. We're seeing revenues being slashed by 30 to, in some cases, 100%. A significant number of workers are being laid off. I'm sure many of you have seen the reports in the news. The Matanuska Brewing Company had to let 147 people go. The folks that own South Bistro, Spinard Brewing, or Spinard Roadhouse, Crush, and Snow City Cafe released 223. The Sheraton released 80. The Fifth Avenue Mall in Anchorage closed down entirely. And Chena Hot Springs released 100 people. And these are just a handful of the larger stories out there, but I can tell you that there are many other businesses out there that are following suit that haven't been noticed yet. Rural Alaska in particular has been having difficulties, especially with moving to remote operations. Most companies are trying to do telework, things like that, or interact with their clients online. It's a little more difficult in the smaller communities, but what we're seeing is a large number of the telecom utilities stepping up and really trying to help out in that front. And I noticed that they're on the agenda later, so I won't steal their thunder, but they have been offering some fantastic opportunities for Alaskans to get online at the time when they need it most. Some of the industries that have been particularly hard hit right off the bat, obviously the food and beverage industry, the entertainment industry, tourism, actually, even though the season hasn't necessarily officially started yet, this is the prime booking season for most of them. And also, unfortunately, because of the seasonal nature of their industry, some of the worst times for them to run into cash flow issues. This is sort of the lowest ebb before the money starts coming in from people booking their trips. Industries that are going to hurt in the near future, we're projecting energy, largely due to the oil price fluctuations on a global scale, manufacturing, seafood, and retail. But to be fair, to be honest, this is such a wide-ranging economic upheaval that every industry in the state is going to be negatively impacted in some sense, with a handful of exceptions. To give you a feel for the scope of how bad this is potentially getting right now, the CEO of Marriott International recently sent out a video to all of his hotels and employees telling them where they were at. He noted that the impact of the COVID virus situation was worse than the impacts that on their business model from 9/11 and the 2009 financial crisis combined. Each of those events caused about a 25% reduction in revenues across the globe. The COVID virus is causing a 75% reduction worldwide. Hundreds of their hotels are closing, and employees are being laid off. All of their food and beverage services has been canceled. SBDC is doing what we can to stay ahead of the crush. We're offering all of our – we've moved all of our online – or all of our workshops online. All of our offices are working remotely. Every training we've got is offering – we're offering it for free now. It seems like a good time to make sure people get the information they need without worrying how to pay for it. We've developed a series of new flyers and training specific to reacting to the impact of the COVID-19 virus. Specifically, we started with the food and beverage administration or food and beverage businesses. We're working with the national restaurant restaurant chain or representatives to develop webinars specific to restaurants trying to transition from in-person dining to takeaway and delivery. We're also moving into ways that we can help the tourism industry and other verticals that are getting hit hardest, fastest. In addition to that, we are working on developing or hiring on new contractors, short-term contractors, to help us with the overflow so that people can get services and assistance as quickly as possible. I have about nine advisors statewide currently, and that is not, it's just not enough, quite frankly. But the good news is we can onboard new contractors. We've been working with several people over the years, and we've been preparing for not this particular event, but something of this nature for quite some time. We're also launching, I believe later today, a dedicated web page that is going to collect all of the business assistance resources, information, and local government and state government websites that we have access to. We're trying to serve as a central repository for small businesses to find what they need as quickly and efficiently as possible. We've been working extensively with local governments across the state, regional economic development organizations, including the ARDRs, and on some levels of the state to try and help get ahead of this, stay informed, make sure that the information that goes out is the most accurate that we can provide, and to let people know what resources are coming down the pipe. It's not all doom and gloom. There is some good news. The state of Alaska is, I believe, next in line to get approved for the SBA disaster assistance loans. This is a loan program that provides funding up to $2 million to qualifying businesses at a rate of 3.75% over 30 years. Nonprofit organization rates, the nonprofits are also eligible, and their rate is 2.75%. This can be used for payroll, accounts payable, other bills that are coming in, things along those lines to keep the businesses afloat. This will help. It's not a silver bullet. Not everybody will be eligible, but this is a step in the right direction. Additionally, Alaskan businesses are stepping up. It's been a really amazing thing to watch, quite frankly. And you mentioned that Mr. Shearhorn is going to be speaking next. The banking community in particular has really done a yeoman's work working with their clients to help find ways to keep their doors open, make sure that they can manage the loan payments, doing all sorts of things without being asked. I mean, it's really good to see that happen. The telecom industry as well, I mentioned that GCI and others are really stepping up to help provide internet to the people that need it most. The transportation industry has been doing phenomenal work. The 5,000 or so individuals, Alaskans, that are employed there have been doing amazing work. And last but of course not least, the shopping or the supermarkets, the stores that are providing the food for folks. The people that work there have been amazing. And the stores themselves have done a fantastic job of trying to prevent hoarding and also many of them offering hours specifically for seniors so that they can get what they need without having to fight the crush of folks that are trying to stock up their larders. Beyond that, you would also ask if we are capable of taking federal dollars. The SBDC program in general is, as far as I can tell, included as in the trillion-dollar relief bill that is currently working its way through Congress. It will provide us with additional funding to expand our operations and provide additional services. My understanding at this point is that that funding does not come with a match requirement, which is very good news. And so at that, if under the current circumstances, we are completely able to accept those funds and we will deploy them as rapidly as possible.
So, Mr. Bittner, on that note, do you need additional receipt authority to do that?
I believe that actually might be the case. I'll have to check with you, but yes, okay. I suspect that is.
You were providing us some amazing information, and we really appreciate it, but I want to give time for committee members to ask a couple questions, as well as Mr. Shearhorn, to chime in. So I'm just going to pause right now and turn it over to Senator Stebbin, if that's okay.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Absolutely, I was done.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think if I recall, the interest rate was around 2.75% and a $2 million cap for small business. Is that correct? Try to write.
Through the chair, the nonprofit rate was 2.75%. The small business interest rate is 3.75%.
And the cap is 2 million?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Madam Chairman, we need to get, I think, some clarity between what the federal response is going to be for small businesses and our state agency, because $2 million in a bridge loan, if you have 25, 50, or 100 employees, isn't going to last long. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure that there's the capacity to deal with some of these small businesses, so when this economy starts livening back up, they can, get back to work, so we don't have losing our losing our small businesses. We'll have nothing to start back up.
Okay, so we will look at that on our end and maybe look at our congressional delegation and ask them about that. Mr. Bittner, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bittner, do you know when you expect the centralized website to be up and going?
Through the chair, yes, sir. We anticipate it to be online today.
Great. And do you have sufficient employees to help you with this extra call volume and additional volume in general?
Through the chair, currently yes, but if the volume continues to grow as exponentially as it has been, no. And so we are looking into hiring contract employees and short-term workers to fill the gap until we can staff up fully.
Okay, great. And do you need any statute change or anything from the state to be able to do that?
Through the chair, I don't believe so, no. But I will double check and get back to you.
Thank you for that. Mr. Bittner, you've been extraordinarily informative, and we really appreciate your invited testimony today. I would like to pivot to Mr. Joe Shearhorn. We have about 8 more minutes here to talk about the private banking center sector, and Mr. Shearhorn is the president and CEO of Northern Bank. Mr. Shearhorn, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to make this presentation to the committee. I had a similar opportunity yesterday with the House Finance Committee, and so I'll try and make similar comments here. First off, as Mr. Bittner had indicated, and as you all are aware, this is a wide sweeping impact to our entire economy. So we have a number of customers who will have entire seasons curtailed almost completely, if not completely, according to the current information that we have, particularly in Southeast Alaska and those throughout our state centered around the tourism industry. And then there are many other rippling effects to this, which you also are aware of. So what are we doing? We're reaching out active. So I'm going to, in part, say what Northern Bank is doing, but really this is couched the financial institutions statewide. I'm representing our bank. I'm a member of the Alaska Bankers Association, but I'm speaking with regards to Northrim here, and I'll flow over a bit to other financial institutions. So we're actively reaching out to our customers to work with them on a case-by-case basis for modifying, deferring payments, offering them additional capital where it makes sense for them. We have indicated to the administration, the state administration, that we would fully support the recently announced state guaranteed loan program, in which the governor is proposing to have a program that mirrors, the best that I can tell, mirrors the SBA program, disaster relief program that Mr. Bittner just alluded to, with a $2 million cap to individuals in need at this point in time. So I view that as a positive, as does the rest of the financial institutions. With regards to our operations, we are open for business with our customers, as I know all financial institutions throughout the state are. We're directing our customers to utilize electronic banking services that we provide to them 24/7. We have a call center that we provide to our customers 24/7 also. But we are open for business throughout the state through our branch system that stretches from Fairbanks all the way down to Ketchikan. And the banking industry within Alaska is quite strong. They've worked very hard since the financial crisis to build up significant reserves of capital and liquidity to be able to provide services to our customers. So we're here to support the state in its efforts to work with all individuals and businesses throughout the state in this time of need. And I can be open for questions that the committee may have, But I just want to stress a few other things prior to your questions. You had asked several times what the state can do. So, one, support the loan guarantee program that the governor is proposing, which may require specific legislation. Not sure how this is going to be affected, but there undoubtedly will be some demands or requests made to you to implement this. Two, there is a huge volume of mortgage refinance activity in the pipeline right now, as well as other transactions that will require recording of deeds of trust in the state recorder's office. It's critical that that office remain open throughout this entire time in order to have the people be able to take advantage of the refinances that are in process and or other purchase transactions. But there is a very, very large volume of that type of business going on now, and it'd be very disruptive if that was curtailed as a result of the recorder's office being closed. So I'll stop now and be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have a question from Senator Stedman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd like to hear from him. I think we're all very comfortable with the fiscal position of our banks. They're mm-hmm. very liquid, well capitalized, and we should be very proud of that. But I'd like to know what's going on with your customers.
Right.
You know, coming in the door, the business community coming in the door, giving you a heads up that they're going to run into trouble, and how far out, you know, that trouble may be. The earlier testimony was a comment, I think, dealing with Marriott Hotels, looking at a precipitous decline relative to the last two economic downturns combined. And I would think the business customers would be sitting across your desk discussing their fiscal position and how to get some help. So can you tell me what's coming in the door?
We're beginning to get those requests. And those businesses that have been more on the front end of this have been more proactive in contacting us and initiating discussions, requesting modifications of their payment structure and or additional working capital to allow them to continue operations, to continue to pay their employees in this time of need. But as this situation has evolved very quickly, particularly over the last month, this is really just beginning, but I anticipate that it will be a very large volume of our activity going forward into the next 90 days. So the first quarter, not much with regards to that, just starting in the past couple of weeks. I anticipate that it will increase greatly, particularly in regards to what I originally said, for those businesses hardest hit in the hospitality, bar, restaurant, hotel, tourism industries, where they've had very, very large, very recent drops in their business.
Senator Stedman.
I think there's a need in the tourism industry, and I'm no expert in the industry by any means, but people prepay for their cruises and their tours and their, you know, all their vacations in Alaska through vacation packages or what have you. Are you seeing a significant amount of that industry coming in asking for help on cash flow, dealing with potential returns of funds for pre-purchasing activity for the summer?
Through the chair, that is beginning to happen, yes. And I would anticipate that we will get many, many more requests going forward as a result of just what you said, because in many cases, I think the entire season will be canceled for a large section of that industry as it stands now. And so they are getting large amounts of cancellations as a result of the current situation, and so I would expect those requests to increase dramatically here over the next 90 days.
So thank you, Mr. Shearhorn. I just want to basically add one last thing here, is that in regards to pledging state assets that the governor announced yesterday, no executive branch can pledge state assets, can appropriate, can provide loan guarantees without, or otherwise, without legislative approval. So that's something that we have to talk about on our end. The other issue is that I think it's imperative to leverage the federal funds where appropriate and where available. And that is, those federal funds are slated to go into the Small Business Administration. And even though Mr. Bittner stated earlier that they did not have a match requirement, which is, it is great news, to the degree where it makes sense, it is imperative that the public and private work together to provide the greatest amount of financial support and spread the risk and share the risk among the different entities and the different funding sources in the foreseeable future. Okay, we are over 2 minutes of our time, so Senator Bishop, you're the last question.
Joe, thanks for presenting here today. Hey, can you confirm that the governor's moratorium on foreclosures applies to private financial institutions, or is that just to the state entities like AHFC?
So through the chair, I believe that is pertaining to Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. So we had a number of discussions with regards to this at the House Finance Committee meeting yesterday. The different mortgage programs that are supplied by investors, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Veterans Administration, would be three major programs out there. Each program is administered according to their own guidelines. Basically, they set their rules with regards to that. And so our state, through our state action through AHFC, is totally separate from all those other programs. So I don't believe that any moratorium that is called with regards to a state program would flow over to a federal program, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Veterans Administration. Now that's I'm just giving you what I believe to be the case. But there is a wide spectrum of mortgages out there that are guided by and controlled by the investors in those programs that basically set the guidelines. So we are actively working with each one, and as are all financial institutions, actively working with each one of those investor-sponsored programs to, again, work with them to be able to work with our customers on deferment or modifications of payments with regards to those types of mortgages.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr.
And then one last comment, just to respond to your comment, Madam Chair, is that our bank, as I know other banks and credit unions too, are engaged with the Small Business Administration, and we will actively support that program with regards to disaster relief financing, as well as work through the SBA and their other available programs. And then we actively work with the Bureau of Administration Affairs, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. There's a number of other agencies that we can leverage in this process to provide financing and also modifications to existing debt out there that is supported by these different agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Shearhorn. We really appreciate both you and Mr. Bittner being on the phone today. Thank you all for what you're doing for Alaska's businesses. It is a critical component in this time. We are going to move on now to food insecurity or food security. We have Kara Durr, the Director of the Public Engagement Food Bank of Alaska, and Adam Ziegler, Executive Director of New Hope. And Mr. Ziegler, is both of these people are directly boots on the ground, right there seeing people face to face. So we have about 15 minutes for you guys. So if you just want to take the floor, let's start with Kara Durr, please.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. So Food Bank of Alaska is a statewide agency. We work in partnership with our three sister food banks in Fairbanks, Kenai, and Juneau, and about 150 agencies statewide. Obviously, food insecurity and ensuring adequate food resources is a huge concern during this pandemic, and our network of food pantries, soup kitchens, and meal programs are really bracing for a huge spike in need in the upcoming months. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about how food banks are responding and then highlight a few federal resources, and Adam can kind of give the on-the-ground perspective. So we're continuing to push food through our normal channels of distribution through our partners, but we're really focusing on adapting to the rising need and then, of course, the unique challenges of the virus that it places on our distribution model. I think the good news is we have a lot of federal commodity food on hand because of the ongoing trade mitigation purchases. And we have a lot more food ordered that will be coming to us in the upcoming weeks. We're likely going to have to purchase some food locally in the next few weeks just to deal with what is going to be a huge spike in need and fill that gap before the other food comes. But overall, I think we feel like we're in a pretty good place to deal with the situation. And we've really just seen a huge outpouring of community support in the last week alone, so that's all really positive. There have been some positive things happening in Congress. The Families First Coronavirus Response Act was signed into law this week, and that has an additional $400 million in commodity purchases, which will be really important for food banks in our network. We have adapted our mobile food pantry distribution, which is happening in Anchorage. We've moved to a pre-box option just to minimize client exposure. We're also going to be handing out grocery gift cards there from thanks to a generous donation from Safeway. And then we are preparing to do delivery of boxes to seniors who want to stay in their homes. I think the shift to pre-boxing is really necessary, but of course with that, it's pretty work intensive. So I know we and our partners are all seeing a need for volunteers, especially as many of our long-term steady volunteers are seniors and are staying home right now. And then I'll just touch on a couple federal resources. Obviously, top of mind is, how are we going to feed kids when schools are closed? The state child nutrition programs and the school district have done a really phenomenal job of applying for waivers really proactively to help get this food to kids. In many cases, grab-and-go meals are provided at select sites. And then we are working with the state to identify districts that are having a hard time with this model, and we're looking at a really promising alternative that USDA just announced, which is a program that mails meals directly to school-age kids in rural communities. And then finally, there's additional resources for school-age kids and their families in the federal bill that I referenced before in the form of supplemental EBT funds. And then SNAP, or food stamps, of course, is going to continue to be a really critical program for Alaskans in need. Experts say that after unemployment insurance, SNAP is the best response to a worsening economy. The Division of Public Assistance has done a tremendous job of quickly applying for waivers and pursuing options that is going to streamline SNAP delivery, and I think they are bracing for a huge spike in applications as well. So if people are unsure if they qualify or want help in applying, they can certainly contact DPA. They can also contact Food Bank of Alaska's outreach team. We're trying to help DPA take some of the pressure off and help clients during this time. And then there are additional investments in SNAP that are being considered in Congress right now, such as raising the minimum benefit and boosting existing benefits, and we're very supportive of this. So kind of what the legislature can do, what we need as a state, I think that as a network, we have really been focusing on trying to pull down more federal food resources. And I think we're reasonably prepared as an anti-hunger network. But I think we really need to think long-term here. I think there's going to be ongoing need to provide more support to our partners in rural communities with food, and particularly with shipping costs, because a lot of this food we're going to receive from the government in the commodities food has limited shipping dollars with it. And then, we're just encouraging a long-term view, because depending on the length and the depth of this economic recession we may be going into, we heavily depend on community donations, and that's really strong right now, but, we could see a huge drop in the coming months. And then finally, I think just making sure that the state agencies who are going to be hit really hard have the employees and resources they need. So all the resources that I mentioned can be found on our website today or Alaska 211, and that's what I have. Thank you.
Ms. Durr, that was very comprehensive, and we appreciate that. So folks can go to the Food Bank of Alaska or United Way 211 and get answers to some of these questions. You did mention federal resources are going to be forthcoming here shortly, but to also remind us to think long term. And I think that's one of the things I'd like to remind, that it's the state that may have to be paying for things that the federal dollars will not pay for, such as shipping food to other parts of Alaska, as well as what's going to happen in October, November, December, fourth quarter of this year. We really appreciate that. The other person on the line is Adam Ziegler with New Hope. Adam, you're up.
All right. I'm glad to be a part of this discussion. Just some things to let you know about on the ground level as we're serving clients. After the first week of social distancing, most pantries have seen about a 50% increase in families coming to use their services. Our pantry specifically saw a 20% increase in new clients, so new families who have never used our food network before. In talking with Covenant House, a lot of their workers have been looking for food pantries to get food for their young adults that they've housed. What they're finding is that SNAP benefits are not going as far as they used to because of the run on grocery stores. Most of the food that people have stockpiled is low-cost food, ramen noodles, low-cost soups, low-cost fruits and vegetables that are canned and frozen. And so that's really minimizing how far SNAP benefits are going right now. We're hearing more stories of people who have lost their jobs and are out of work needing food. Every grocery bag saves them money and allows them to keep the lights on, allows them to keep themselves in their homes. We are anticipating growing numbers over the next 2-3 weeks. And if we continue to see 50% increases every week, we're really going to see a stretch on the food security systems that are in place, whether it's our food pantry or other food pantries around the state. And so I encourage, as Kara did, to think about delayed response, not just immediate responses. The SNAP waiver for able-bodied adults is a great first step. I heard from the AHFC, the Homeless Prevention Program, funding that is making sure that stays in place is going to be a huge benefit in the months to come, and then also investing in the shipping and supply chains. Any ways that we can support them in our communities is going to be excellent. One of the things I do want to add to what Kara said was there's also an app available called Got Food with a question mark. It's a very easy resource for legislators when folks call your office. Just type in their zip code, and it'll give you soup kitchens and food pantries in that community. And that's GOTFOOD with a question mark, Got Food.
Thank you very much. What are your fund sources in a normal year? Do you have state? Is it all private funding? What are your fund? What's your revenue source?
So I can only speak for our food pantry. Our programs are mostly privately funded with a few business contributions. Our program doesn't receive any state or federal funding. So we're looking at reduced funding in the future as folks are cutting back on their generous contributions and their giving to nonprofits.
Okay, so it might make sense then for the state to just look at and consider that as we debate this and see if it makes sense to provide funding specifically for food pantries across the state and how that might look like. So we'll think about that. And thank you very much. I hate
Absolutely.
To cut you guys both off now, but we're going to continue to move on with broadband. So Ms. Durr and Mr. Ziegler, fantastic testimony today. Thank you. Our next up is connectivity, broadband, and education. And we have a whole host of folks online. how are we going to do this? I think we're going to start off. O'Connor, okay. So Christine O'Connor with Alaska Telecom Association. Just a couple minutes then, because we've got a bunch of folks that we're going to kind of go up and down the line. So Ms. O'Connor, can you tell us about what's happening in your world and how you're doing, what are you doing to kind of help increase broadband across Alaska? Take it away. Christine just dropped off. Great.
Tyson Gallagher.
Okay, Tyson Gallagher with GCI. Did you hear what I just said? Can you do that?
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear.
Hi there. I'm sure Christine will be back in a minute. I'll speak briefly to some of the things GCI is doing during this time, absolutely recognizing that people are going to be spending more time at home. They're going to be working from home. Kids are going to be going to school from home. And generally, people are going to be using the Internet a lot more, and they're going to be using it at the same time. GCI has extended an offer statewide where if you're a current GCI home Internet customer, we will upgrade you to the next plan up the level, up the ladder, so you get more speed and more data to use at home. And if you are not a home Internet customer, we will offer you free entry-level Internet for the next 2 months. And I'm available to answer any questions if anybody has any.
So thank you for that. I guess the question is, if you talked about people – if everyone's using it at once, could that potentially crash our system?
I think Christine will speak at a higher level to the statewide abilities, but I think we feel confident in our ability to maintain our networks. It kind of depends on the technology serving a community. If they have a middle mile connection through fiber or satellite or microwave technology, that can bring about some capacity constraints, but overall we feel confident that the network can handle this increased demand at this time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gallagher, talking about free entry-level internet next couple months, extended offer statewide to upgrade you to the next plan. I saw that Senator Wilson had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Gallagher, for being online. After the 2 months, does someone need to cancel that plan if they got upgraded, or would they be charged, or would they automatically be demoted back down? How will that work?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, thank you for that question. I think we've got a piece of information we're trying to get out to offices. It just got approved yesterday for me, so I'm getting that to everybody if I haven't gotten it to you yet. We're going to automatically upgrade our customers' plans who are existing customers, and at the end of that time frame, that will automatically revert back down. For people that are not currently customers and would seek to get that free entry-level plan, that comes with a Wi-Fi modem. You would need to return that modem at the end of the time period. Otherwise, the billing would continue.
Senator Wilson, followed by Senator Hoffman.
Yes, and how will that work for sort of your microwave or satellite customers out in more of the rural areas?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, thank you for that question. Part of what we're the logistics we're trying to get our arms around is our ability to actually work directly with our customers. We're devising a variety of scenarios where we may leave home install kits with instructions, and then we've actually closed a lot of our stores in Anchorage, and we've converted them to call centers to provide additional help to people. So we're kind of still getting our arms around that to the greatest extent, but we want to make sure that everyone's connected during this time.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gallagher, I thank you for that that service that you're offering people of Alaska in this time that we're having a lot of stress. But the question that I have is, how are you disseminating that information so that all people of Alaska can benefit from this, people in the far reaches of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, thank you for that question, sir. I appreciate that's a really good question. We are currently trying to communicate through to our customers through primarily through email and social media posts at this time, as well as we're working directly with our commercial customers, our business clients. as well as at a residential or customer level to communicate options to people. In addition to the measures that I mentioned, we're also working with those eligible applicants to get them signed up for the FCC's Lifeline program, which would provide access to a low-cost wireless device that could be used potentially as a hotspot. And we're working with the Department of Education to deliver education on a broader level as well.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher, for that comprehensive explanation. And thank you for what you're doing with the businesses and with the families here and households. I see that we have Ms. Christine O'Connor with Alaska Telecom back on.
Madam Chair, before Mr. Tyson leaves, yes. At the appropriate time, I'd like to ask him a question.
Well, so here's what we'd like to do is there are some granular questions about how GCI is handling, you know, different customers and so forth, but folks can ask GCI directly. If it's a more of a larger, you know, umbrella type of question, by absolutely, but I also, we have about four or five people online for this. Okay. Senator Olson?
You want me to ask it now?
Yeah, he's on the line right now.
Mr. Tyson, good morning.
Good morning, Senator.
I have in front of me what GCI has done for the internet options for Alaska K through 12 students and teachers. And one of the things that I did on the 17th of March, I wrote a letter to GCI in particular, and was wondering, as you look at some of these options that are for the essentially the rail belt or the those customers that are out there, as opposed to those people, especially the students that are trying to go ahead and continue on with their education. What has all I see is there's going to be a free upgrade to the next level of CERT plan, but that includes a higher charge. I guess I'm asking, is there any consideration that you will not charge the extra fees for this at this time?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, thank you for that question, sir. I was hoping you'd ask that. I saw you'd written that letter. I saw it on Facebook, so I appreciate you posting that. So to answer your question, we are taking steps to offer free additional data and speed to all of our customers statewide, both in urban and rural Alaska. Like I said earlier, recognizing that everybody's going to be at home, everybody's going to be using the internet more, and they're going to be using it simultaneously because they're all at home, we wanted to find a way to provide more data and more speed to everyone. But recognizing that different parts of our network have different constraints, depending on some of the variables that I'm sure Christine will get into, whether it's technology or capacity constraints. And so in order to keep our network viable on a broad scale and be able to deliver premium levels of service to everyone, rather than offering unlimited service or mitigating those overages altogether, we've just upgraded everyone to the next plan free of charge. And so we think that that will provide the greatest lift to everyone while maintaining the network's viability. Does that make sense, sir?
It does. And as the only internet provider for much of rural Alaska, I want to thank you for what you've done so far. And with that, thank you, Madam Chair. No further questions.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Thank you. So I would like to hear Alaska Telecom. Ms. Christine O'Connor, can you hear us?
Thank you, Chair, and my apologies. I had technical difficulty on my end. My name is Christine O'Connor, for the record, and I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Telecom Association. With me on the line today and available for questions, as you've heard, Tyson Gallagher from GCI, but also from Alaska Communications, Heather Cavanaugh and Rick Benkin, from Aztec, Jen Leipenix and Luke Middle, and from MTA, Michael Burke. This morning, I would like to give you a brief update on the status of Alaska's telecom networks in light of the difficult circumstances surrounding the COVID-19 virus. Our goal during this time is to keep our employees safe and customers connected. Alaska's telecom providers are following guidelines from the CDC and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, as well as guidance from Speaker Edgemon and the Bush Caucus advising against travel to villages or at a minimum consultation with local leaders. We are also following the governor's advice that is given daily as far as travel and other safety restrictions. In thinking about the capabilities of Alaska's telecom networks, which Tyson has already given you some very good detailed information, at an overview, it is important to understand that they use different technologies that have different capabilities. In our more populated areas, the connection to the internet is undersea fiber from South Central to Seattle, and that is a robust connection. It's scalable and allows relatively quick increases in response to demand. Over 80% of Alaskans are served by that fiber backhaul. In regions without access to fiber middle mile, they may be connected to the internet by microwave and our satellite connections. And these technologies have much more limited capacity, but local systems are calibrated for available bandwidth. A recurring concern I've heard recently, and that was raised today, correctly so, is can the networks handle the influx of traffic from telework, distance education, quarantine, and people just staying home to protect others through social isolation? Yes, the networks are handling the increased load at this time. To give a little perspective around this issue, Alaska Communications has shared that the increase in traffic they are seeing now is actually less than what they have experienced when the last two versions of Call of Duty were released. The networks are performing well. All providers are monitoring usage levels. Monitoring network performance is standard practice to ensure proper traffic management, detect and resolve problems before they impact users, and minimize disruptions as quickly as possible. These things are baked into how we operate networks, and they help ensure Alaskans remain connected. ATA members are working in partnership with communities to expand access to residents. For example, in the MATSU, MTA is working with the cities and borough to create drive-in hotspots so people can access the internet from their cars, both providing access to those who may be lacking and supporting the social distancing that is so important right now to everyone's safety. We recognize this situation is bringing severe economic burdens to many Alaskans. ATA's members have committed to the Keep Americans Connected pledge, which includes commitments to, one, not terminate service to any residential or small business customers because of their inability to pay their bills due to the disruptions caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Two, waive any late fees that any residential or small business customers incur because of their economic circumstances related to the coronavirus pandemic. And three, open existing Wi-Fi hotspots to any American who needs them. In addition, additional hotspots are being added. In addition to these measures, families needing greater assistance may qualify for discounted internet service through the Lifeline program. More information on this program is available on every provider's website or by just calling their local provider. And we have many local providers, GCI, of course, but then statewide, we have multiple other local providers that are also offering Lifeline. We are actively working with all anchor institutions in our areas on what they need and how we can support them in the short term and long term. Also, we are keeping in close contact with other utilities in our areas and coordinating our efforts to the maximum extent possible. We are coordinating with the federal response teams and keeping them appraised, as well as various state agencies working on this crisis. We are also working with the Rural Healthcare Program participants to increase bandwidth for healthcare facilities as needed at no charge. The length of time to implement these increases will depend on the Federal Communications Commission guidance and their waiver of certain rules, which currently define bandwidth through September 30th of 2020. The other most frequent question we've gotten in the past week is about how we can help while schools are closed. ATA's member companies, including those on the line, have made commitments to support students and teachers. ADTAC is providing credits for increased usage. Alaska Communications is providing free service. GCI is providing a free service or upgrades. And MTA is offering free upgrades. Every provider is working with school districts throughout the state to identify solutions that fit their schools and the networks that are available. ATA is coordinating with Commissioner Johnson and the Alaska Council of School Administrators to do everything we can to help kids keep learning. We just want to assure you and all Alaskans that every telecom provider in Alaska is responding and is committed to helping our state, our communities, and our neighbors stay connected. Thank you for inviting us this morning. We are all available and happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor, for that comprehensive overview. We have our first question from Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor, for being available today. And I guess my question is for all industries, but since you're on the phone, and I appreciate the no late fees and looking back not to disconnect service for lack of payment, but sooner or later the bill is going to come due. How many months will you offer the non-disconnect for lack of payment? Because as soon as someone gets a job, they're going to be a month or 2 months behind in all their bills and payments. And I can only imagine trying to play catch-up is going to take a quite a long time if you don't offer a discounted rate or just don't offer a rate payment for that entire month. Then that person's always going to be underwater trying to catch back up to pay all their bills from all utilities. I'm just trying to see how long will that disconnect payment last under this circumstance.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Wilson. That's a great question, and I think it is developing daily how long this situation is going to last. We are working closely with our national association, and also ATA is communicating with our congressional delegation as far as resources that may be needed in the long term to support this. I think it's very clear from what we're hearing today that there will be a long time for consumers to catch up. So I don't have a specific end date, because I think we just don't know how long this will last and how much resources will be needed. But it is on our minds for sure.
I think this pandemic is a gift that's just going to keep on giving over the next several months. And I think the fallout is unknown at this time, from individuals to households to businesses. And I think it's important for everyone to kind of stay flexible as we move forward, but also keeping an eye on liquidity. We have, like I said, folks from all over the state right now, but Ms. O'Connor does sort of speak for the group. We do have the supply chain up next, if we want to continue with that, or unless we have any more questions for broadband at this point. Thank you. All folks on the connectivity, thank you so much for including the issue with education. That is a big deal for our elementary school kids, high school kids, adult learning, and so forth, and university, to maintain online classes for the foreseeable future, since it looks like schools are going to be closed probably for the rest of the year. So thank you all very much for being here on a Saturday, and we really appreciate it. So the last presenter for today is the supply chain, and we just want to make sure that we just don't run out of toilet paper. And Mr. Bal Dreyfus, the Senior Vice President of Alaska of Matson, is on the line. And I think, Mr. Dreyfus, what we definitely want to hear is how it's going in your world, and are you able to meet the demand in Alaska, and what are some of the bottlenecks that you're experiencing?
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. So my name is Bal Dreyfus, and I'm a Senior Vice President of Alaska for Matson. And I very much appreciate this opportunity to address the Senate to provide an update on our continued services to Alaska. And the good news is we are operating without interruption. And I would also note that you can continually get updates on our website at matson.com. I'd also add that we get it. We understand the important role that we play in all the communities we serve, including Alaska, and we're committed to taking all the appropriate steps to ensure the continuation of services, including deployment of reserve vessels, if we need them, to continue to meet the needs of our customers in Alaska. So what does that mean? It means our sailings, which are twice a week, from Tacoma to Anchorage, will continue as they have since the beginning of this COVID-19, twice weekly to Kodiak and weekly to Dutch Harbor. So by example, we sailed last Wednesday from Tacoma. The ship will be in tomorrow. And we sailed last night from Tacoma, and the ship will arrive Tuesday night. Both ships were full of all the needed cargo, so I think people can feel comfortable and confident that the goods are coming to market. In addition, the other carriers, TOAT, AML, Samson, the Alaska Railroad, are all continuing their service without interruption to Alaska. So I think from a supply chain standpoint, the supply chain and all the stakeholders in that have worked very well together to make sure that the workers are there to do the work to get the ships moving and the goods delivered once they get to the destination via truck or to the warehouse. So I think we can all feel very confident about that. I'd add, we continue to monitor all the CDC updates and Coast Guard regulations to make sure that our employees are safe and the supply chain is safe so we can continue to deliver that cargo. I'd add that I think that the teamwork has been outstanding, not just internally with our employees and their willingness to come to work and do what we need to do to get the goods delivered, but for everyone in the supply chain, including our customers, who I've had many conversations with and who are committed to serving Alaska and making sure that Alaska gets what we need here in Alaska. Another note, we have expanded our technology to enable more employees to work from home, which has been great. So we very much appreciate the efforts that we just heard from our technology companies here to expand the network, as obviously more people are working from home and the demand on that network is much greater, including those watching more movies at home. So I would add that the Matson team continues to work together to ensure that continuity of services, again, including the deployment of reserve vessels if they became necessary to continue to meet the needs of our customers in Alaska. And we'll continue to collaborate with the service providers and stakeholders in this regard. So, again, we do provide the regular updates on Matson.com. We're also using social media, so Facebook, because we recognize the importance of communication during this period. And particularly where there's misinformation or misunderstandings, we want to make sure that people are getting accurate information. But I think we can all feel very comfortable that the supply chain is working very effectively, and I think we'll continue to. So thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to address the Finance Committee. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Senator Olson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Dreyfus, I thank you very much for keeping the supply facilities open and the barges running. But my concern has to do not so much with the operation that Matson and the other sea-based transporters have, but has to do with the port there in Tacoma that you're sailing from. It's my understanding that there were some issues related to the longshoremen that were either not showing up for work, and there was a consideration that the National Guard was going to be deployed in order to make sure that those vessels that you had sailing north would be filled with the containers that are needed. Is that a concern to you at this point, or does that fear, can that be allayed to the?
No, I think that's not a concern. I mean, the labor on the West Coast in Tacoma in particular has been very good, as they always have when we have these crises, whether it's 9/11 or anything else. They come to work and get the job done, knowing that we have an obligation to keep goods moving through.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. No further questions.
Thank you, Senator Olson. That was actually a concern of mine as well. We just want to make sure that the Tacoma port stays open for business and that the supply chains actually across the country that services the collect our goods at Tacoma can continue to Alaska. Senator Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to expand on that question. What about our Anchorage port? Is there any issues with maintaining that under this circumstance?
No, we've had no issues at all in Anchorage. Everything is working great. The labor is working, which is fantastic.
Thank you. This is great news. Do we have any other further questions at all from committee members? Mr. Dreyfus, that was a very good summary. We really appreciate it. I think it's just reassuring to know that goods and services are still going to be coming into Alaska. Of course, we're hoping to make sure that we've got sufficient medical supplies, which are in short order around the state, protective gear, gloves, ventilators, and things of that nature. But we just appreciate you giving us confidence and reassurance. So that is...
You're very welcome.
Thank you. That is that's the conclusion for today. So we heard some great testimony today about the efforts being made all across Alaska to provide financial assistance, broadband, food, and other goods. I think several of us took notes on the ways the state could help in these efforts, both in statute, federal receipt authority, or direct state financial support. And in particular, we have an unemployment insurance bill that we need to definitely move soon. So we're going to close this meeting at this time, but we are going to probably meet again this afternoon, so be aware, and we'll let committee members know when that happens. So it's about 10 minutes to 11, and we're going to recess until about 1 o'clock, okay? So at this point, thank you very much, and we'll see you soon. call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Saturday, March 21st, and the time is about 3:05 p.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha Von Imhoff, and I'm joined today by Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Wilson. We also have Senator Rivak and Senator Giesel here, and Representative Sponholz is with us as well. We have a quorum to do business. Our first, our only item at this time is the HB 308 unemployment benefits for COVID-19. At this time, this is an act relating to unemployment benefits during a period of state or national emergency resulting from a novel coronavirus COVID-19 outbreak and providing for an effective date. Senate Finance heard the companion bill, Senate Bill 240, on March 19, 2020. I'd like to start by having committee staff describe the differences between the proposed Senate Finance CS and the bill that was presented to the committee and take a motion to adopt the CS. So, Mr. Julie Lucky, and then we'll have comments from the committee members.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky, staff of the Senate Finance Committee working in Senator Von Imhoff's office. Each of your offices should have received the CS version U and the explanation of changes. It's a bit hot off the presses today, so hopefully you received it, but if not, the changes are minimal and I think easy to understand, and I will point them out in this presentation. There were two changes from the bill that was presented in the Senate Finance Committee previously. The first change is that the period that the protections against disqualification in this bill apply has been lengthened. The original period was 90 days. In this version, it is 120 days. That was a house that change was made in the House bill before it came to the committee, so that is not part of the Senate Finance changes. You'll see that number on page 2, line 4. The only change in the Senate Finance CS is the addition of Section 5, which adds a retroactivity clause until March 1st, 2020. For the members that were at the hearing this morning, this was a change that was requested by the division. I believe division personnel are online to confirm that. Those are the only changes to the bill that will not. We have confirmed that the changes in the Senate Finance CS will not change the fiscal impact. The previous, we did not review this fiscal note at the previous meeting. So, Madam Chairman, if I could take a moment now, I can review the fiscal note for you.
Yes, please.
It is fiscal note number 1, previously published. The department is the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Appropriation is Employment and Training Services. The allocation is Unemployment Insurance. And the OMB component number is 2276. There is only one fiscal note that applies to this bill. It is an indeterminate fiscal note. They will need to have a regulations change. And the narrative does speak to why it would be indeterminate, but as I said, the director should be online if the committee would like a little bit more detail. I think the indeterminate, it's basically because it is difficult to assess the fiscal impacts because they are unsure how many people will actually be applying. But as I said, the department personnel are online to describe more of why they came up with an indeterminate fiscal note. Those are all of the changes in the CS, Madam Chairman.
Do we have any questions in regards to the changes before I turn to Patsy Westcott, who's online? Okay. Ms. Westcott, you heard the changes of the CS and the discussion of the fiscal note. Could you comment on the CS as well as the fiscal note based on what we talked about this morning?
Chair Von Imhoff, this is Patsy Westcott with the Division of Employment and Training Services at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. At the time we submitted the fiscal note, we submitted it as an indeterminate fiscal note because we were still in the process of evaluating what it would take for us to implement these changes and then consequently the need to respond to the increase in what we anticipate as far as workload. As far as what it would take to implement the changes, those are negligible. It's a matter of programming changes, which we can easily absorb through our federal administrative grant that we receive from the United States Department of Labor.
with regard to the influx of claims workload that we anticipate receiving, that is still questionable. We've experienced already a significant increase in workload, but we absolutely feel that we are in a position to respond to that workload. We've already taken measures to realign staff, expand our hours, offer overtime. But again, all of this is, the unemployment insurance program is federally funded as far as our administrative costs. And so we feel that we are in a position to be able to respond to that. As I mentioned this morning, in the hearing this morning, the only question is federal authority to spend the money that we have. And so that's the only place that I think that we might need some additional assistance is in additional federal authority.
So thank you for the federal authority. The appropriate place to add that is in the budget, and we definitely made a note of that request, and we are working on it on our end to put it in the budget. Do we have any questions by committee members for Ms. Westcott? Senator Bishop?
I do, after we move the CS.
Okay. So before we do that, before we move the CS, we're going to invite Representative Ivy Sponholz to the table, and you can let us know if you agree to the changes and any other comments.
Sure. Representative Ivy Sponholz, House District 16. I want to thank you for taking up this bill with such urgency. COVID-19 is a public health emergency, but it's also creating an economic emergency and hardship for a lot of Alaskans. I support all of the changes that have been made in the CS. I think that they improve it and help to ensure that we can get financial support out to underemployed Alaskans as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Representative Sponholz? Thank you very much for being here. So, do we have any other questions about the bill before we make a motion? Senator Bishop, can I have a motion to adopt the CS?
Madam Chair, I move the Senate Finance Committee substitute for committee substitute for House Bill 308, version uniform, before the committee as our working document.
Is there objection to adopting the CS? Seeing no objection, the CS is adopted. Okay. Does the committee have any further questions or discussion? Senator Bishop, do you have a question about federal payments?
I have three questions for Ms. Westcott. Ms. Westcott, are PFDs included in base period wages?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no, they are not.
Question number two, would a federal dividend be included in base period wages?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no, they are not.
Third, last question, would an independent contractor or sole proprietorships be covered under UI?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no. Typically, they would not be covered under regular unemployment insurance.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Are people who are employed for companies like Uber, Lyft, kind of the gig economy, are they covered by unemployment insurance?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Yes and no. A couple of years ago, the Alaska legislature changed legislation to exempt Uber drivers and Lyft drivers or transportation network drivers from the definition of covered employment, and so they would not be covered under unemployment insurance. That provision does not apply to drivers who deliver anything other than passengers. So drivers who deliver food or go to a restaurant or go to a grocery store and pick up items and deliver it to a recipient, that exemption does not include those drivers. So those drivers would be considered employees.
Senator Wachowski, follow up.
Do we have any number of Uber and Lyft drivers that are being impacted by this coronavirus?
Through the chair, Senator Wachowski, I do not have any data on Uber or Lyft drivers in the state of Alaska because they're not covered under unemployment insurance, and so they're not at this time required to report to us.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any other further questions for Patsy Westcott or Senator or Representative Sponholz? Senator Bishop, can I have a motion to move the bill from committee?
Madam Chair, I move the Senate Finance Committee substitute for committee substitute for House Bill 308, version uniform, from committee with the individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection to moving the bill from committee? Seeing no objection, this bill moves from committee. Okay, please, members, please stay to sign inside the sign the committee report. At this time, we will recess. Senator Bishop, or excuse me, Sedman.
Yeah, just a brief heads up for committee members. We have a couple of amendments that are over drafters on the operating budget, and we have a brief presentation of the OMB numbers that we'll do beforehand. So we'll give everybody about a 20-minute heads up or something when we're ready. So we're going to get it here as quick as we can so we can be done by before dinner.
So at this time, we will recess the meeting to the call of the chair.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Finance Committee back to order from recess. It's March 21st, 2020, official time, 7 minutes after 4 p.m. We have this late afternoon Co-Chair Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilson. We're missing one senator. He will be here shortly. He's in the building. We have two items on the agenda this afternoon. First, I thought we would have a quick presentation on the short and long-term revenue impacts of the upcoming budget we're going to talk about next, is House Bill 205, the operating and the capital budget for this year, and the difficulty that the committee has with the restricted revenues due to declining oil prices, and a few other factors, and then trying to deliver a dividend to the people, which we'll be talking about here shortly. So with that, I've invited Legislative Finance to do a kind of a revenue overview. So if Director Pat Pitney could come forward, that would be appreciated. She's got a few slides, and after she's done, then we'll start the process of the operating budget. And then we'll be done for the day.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney. I'm Director for Legislative Finance Division. This is a very short slide deck, but just to give an overview on the impact of the decline in the price of oil, as well as the impact on the market, on the permanent fund value, and thus the percent of market value annual draw to the state. Start out with the price of oil. We have three graphs here that we're going to start out with, and they're all scaled the same. So this is our traditional revenue, and the traditional revenue is largely made up of petroleum income. We were just under $3 billion for fiscal year 19. Oops, back up. Under $3 billion for fiscal year 19. We expected to be about that for fiscal year 20. With the recent, well, we were expecting to be just over $2 billion in fiscal year 20. So this blue bar is our fall forecast. This is what we were expecting our revenue from, primarily oil, but there's also things like marijuana tax, motor fuel tax, some corporate income tax from entities other than oil that are in this particular line. But it's primarily made up of petroleum royalties, production tax, and others. So based on $40 a barrel oil, we have this red line. Okay. That's a $600 million difference on average across the time frame fiscal year 21 to fiscal year 29. So we have $600 million less coming in from our traditional revenue streams. That's at $40 a barrel oil. We're hovering closer to $35 a barrel oil. Assuming $35 a barrel oil on an inflation-adjusted basis, we would have $700 million less. So in the range of $1.2 billion in traditional revenue. Okay. Our second stream of funding is our percent of market value draw, and that's taking 5% essentially of our permanent fund value on an annual basis. There's a formula that makes that up, but it's roughly, that's the simple version of how we receive our percent of market value. The way that is calculated is to only draw from the permanent fund that amount that over time the permanent fund can continue to grow at inflation. So the permanent fund's value is as strong for the future generation as it is today. At this point, we have $2.9 billion from the percent of market value in 19, just over $3 billion. The effects of the market are delayed in the percent of market value because it's on a five-year rolling average. At the peak, assuming just the drop that we've seen as of yesterday, at the peak, we will have $400 million less than what we had expected from our fall revenue source. If that recovery is slow, if we have the drop we've had, only the drop we've had that we've seen through yesterday, March 19th, and we don't have growth next year, but then the growth increases to 10% for 5 years and 7% going forward, we would have a peak loss of $700 million in 27. So the fortunate thing with the percent of market value, because it's on a delayed measure, the near term is we don't see nearly the impact that we see with the oil in the near term, but we see a tremendous impact on the annual percent of our annual revenue stream in the out years. Now, combining the two, again, we're looking at the same scale. Combining the two, our blue bar was our fall revenue stream. We were expecting it to be over $6 billion by fiscal year 29. The red bar is at $40 a barrel oil and steady recovery. One drop and then a return, decent returns after that, just one drop. We have a $1 billion difference at the peak. The $1 billion difference at the peak of the decline, which is fiscal year 26, that's when the five-year average is built in on the percent of market value and the oil price. Now let's say we're at $35 a barrel oil and we take an additional year to recover. Our peak difference is $1.5 billion. This is $1.5 billion less in revenue a year. So our revenue is going from what we were hoping to be $6 billion to around $4.6 billion in the out years. The amazing figures are the cumulative impact on revenue. Cumulatively, this gap between fall forecast and the $40 barrel and steady recovery is a cumulative $8 billion of revenue that does not exist in our revenue streams from what we were thinking last fall. And if the oil stays at $35 a barrel, it'd be an $11 billion cumulative drop in the revenue stream across the time period 21 to 29. So significant differences in our fiscal state over the last 2-week period. So what does that mean relative to our spending? Again, we have three slides here and this is using the more modest declines in revenue, $40 per barrel impact, and the more modest case, the quick steady recovery on the permanent fund. We start with our unrestricted general fund revenue assumption based on this. We go from 4.8 billion in 2020 down to 4.4 billion in revenue for 22. We have our spending figures. So the total spending, not counting supplementals, last year was 4.3. We had 360 million in supplementals. Also included in last year's spending was a $1,600 dividend, which was $1.1 billion. Because of the drop in the revenue, we anticipate a $728 million draw on the CBR after $142 on CBR for the capital budget and after $172 million draw from the SBR for the dividends. So we expect the year-end balance for the CBR to be $1.5 billion. And the year end is June 30, 2020. With that, coming into 2020 with the spending level that's before you and additional capital budget items and $100 million supplemental, we would have a $300 million deficit, and that's on line 12. We'd have a $300 million supplemental without a dividend and without any money towards stimulus. So that would draw down the CBR to just under $1.4 billion. Okay. Down here you can see the ERA balance started with $16 billion at the beginning of this year. We anticipate that to be about $12 billion at the end of the year, and much lower returns into the into the earnings reserve account. Okay, so with the $300 million deficit, the CBR is still able to handle it. Oh. And then coming coming into 22, again, this assumes no stimulus and no dividends. You would still, now you would have a $500 million deficit. And the CBR balance would be below a billion. An ERA balance of 8.5. So the next scenario assumes a $400 per person dividend and a $100 million stimulus. Okay, FY20 remains the same. FY21, $100 million stimulus. $294 million for dividends for a $400 dividend. Now we have almost a $700 million deficit, and this year the CBR is drawn below a billion. Oops, sorry, can't click. All right, down below a billion. Okay, and no additional draws on the ERA except for the percent of market value draw. 22. No dividend, no stimulus. We have, again, that $500 million deficit. That $500 million deficit draws our CBR down to just under $600 million. Given the tight cash flow arrangement, really drawing the CBR below $600 million requires another cash flow solution for the state. And so this $600 million is, or this 563 is about as low as you want to take the CBR unless you want to find another source of ongoing cash flow for the state. So the next scenario we put forward, same revenue scenario at $40 a barrel oil. This one includes a $1,000 dividend per person and a $300 million stimulus. So here's the stimulus at $300 million. Here's the permanent fund dividend on line 8, $675 million. $1,000 dividend. That's a $1.2 billion deficit. That $1.2 billion deficit would draw the CBR down to that $600 million mark and require an ad hoc draw from the permanent fund earnings reserve. And that ad hoc draw, estimated right now at $40 a barrel oil, could be around, you know, $276 million. In the next year, no dividend, no stimulus. The deficit again is at $500 million. Because we've drawn down the CBR, you have another ad hoc draw on the earnings reserve. So understand, for every $1 billion of draws out of the earnings reserve, you reduce future annual POMV revenue by $50 million. So you're already reducing your future cash flows on top of what we're going to see due to the market crash and the oil price crash. So with that, I can take any questions.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you go over the deposits on line 14? What do those numbers represent?
So the deposits on light 14, this is deposits into the CBR. These are oil tax settlements, and the $235 million is the amount already received in fiscal year 20. 75 and 75 are estimates. Those could be 150, they could be 50. But this is an estimate based on the Department of Revenue's forecast.
Any other questions on the presentation? Okay, thank you. Director Pitney, for putting this together. We'll now take a brief at ease while we set up to deal with the operating budget. We're at ease. like to go ahead and call the committee back from recess. What we have for the public, what we have on the table today is Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill number 205, version O, finance, which is a long, fancy term for the operating budget for FY21 and a good portion of the capital budget for FY21. And we're going to now consider amendments from the committee, and I will go ahead and move amendment number one and object for a discussion. We have Mr. Pete Eklund, who is the lead for the Finance Committee on the operating budget, and he will explain amendment number one, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Pete Eklund's staff to Senate Finance and Chair Stedman. Amendment number one in front of you, Mr. Chairman, is more or less a technical cleanup amendment. One dealing with the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. It's restoring $110,000 of ADA receipts that was left out inadvertently. And then another one is in Civil Division, Department of Law, Labor and State Affairs. It's deleting $400,000 of UGF and adding some intent.
Okay, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the amendment. We have any questions? Any further objections to the adoption of the amendment? Seeing no further objection to the adoption of the amendment, amendment number one is adopted. I'd like to go ahead and move amendment number two and object for discussion and explanation. Mr. Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number two has three components to it. On page one of two, the first component is adding in the Village Safe Water Program, what we typically refer to in the capital budget. It's water and sewer projects all across Alaska, Mr. Chairman. It's $20.9 million of federal receipts, $4.8 million of general fund match, and $200,000 of statutory designated receipts. The second part of the amendment is in Commerce, Community, and Economic Development for the Alaska Energy Authority, Rural Power Systems Upgrades. That's $12.5 million of federal receipts and $5 million of unrestricted general funds. And on page two of two, number three is what we refer to as NPRA, National Petroleum Reserve Alaska Impact Grant Program of $13.1 million.
Okay. I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption. Do you have any further questions, Senator Olson? Then we'll go to Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's one name missing from amendment number two, and that has to do with the senator to the right of me.
Could you repeat that? I didn't follow.
On the amendment, the number of senators that were involved, there is a name that's missing, and that's the member from West Fairbanks.
Well, Senator Bishop, would you like to be a co-sponsor of this amendment?
Yeah, I thought I was in the meeting, and I don't know how my name got left off of it.
Too, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'll take Senator Bishop, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Wilson. Okay, that's good. I would ask for a vote, but the whole table has co-sponsored it. So. Any other comments, concerns on this amendment? Any further objection to the adoption of this amendment? Seeing none, amendment number two is adopted. Amendment number three by Senator Stedman, and I'll go ahead and move the amendment and object for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the amendment does, it proposes to move $680 million from the general fund to the dividend fund to pay an approximately $1,000 dividend this fall in October, the normal dividend cycle.
Okay, so if I hear you correctly, this is the $1,000 standard dividend time frame in October for each Alaskan that qualifies for a permanent fund dividend.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We have, I'll go ahead and move my objection for the, well, I'll maintain my objection for discussion. Any further discussion on this amendment? Senator Vonimoff.
So I do object to this amendment. I think based on what we just heard, I think to pay a large dividend at this point has serious fiscal consequences. And I would rather focus on paying stimulus money and COVID-19 associated money directly to the people who truly need it in regards to food security, which we heard today, energy assistance, supplemental unemployment benefits, things of that nature.
Okay, we have further objection. Senator Volkowski.
I'll just comment, Mr. Chairman. I think this amount is woefully inadequate. We've got a crisis unlike any we've seen in our lifetimes. We've got tens of thousands of Alaskans out of work because we've ordered them out of work. We've got a unemployment benefits. We just passed a bill, which is a good bill. I'm going to support it. But we have the lowest unemployment replacement wage in the United States. We're 52 out of 52 jurisdictions. This is far below what the statute requires. I'd rather have the people get something rather than nothing, but I think this is woefully inadequate for the crisis situation that we're currently in, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I agree with Senator Wilikowski's comments to a point, because I'm afraid this might be the last one for a while. And I would like to make sure that my kids and grandkids and future generations get the goodie out of this state that I have got in the last 45 years. And I'm just concerned. I'd like to spread it out over several years. Thank you.
You have other comments on this? I'll go ahead and Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at the permanent fund dividend, it's one of the things that was pointed out by the previous speakers that at this time where businesses are ceasing to have in revenue and families across the state of Alaska are continuing to have rent payments, pay for groceries, pay for utilities and all those things, I find that this amount is weighting the balances and found wanting, but I feel like it's a good first step in getting this thing crisis under control. And so because of that, I will be supporting this amendment.
Okay. Any comments on this amendment? Okay, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption. Any further objection to the adoption?
I object.
Okay. Any comments? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bishop?
No.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
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 Senator
Olson?
Yes.
Senator Wilkowski?
No. Senator Sedman?
Yes.
Senator Vonimoff?
No.
4 yeas, 3 nays.
Okay, motion passes. Amendment number 3. Now we're off to amendment number 4. Senator Wilkowski, would you like to offer amendment number 4?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman. Can we take a brief at ease?
We'll have a brief at ease. back on the record. We have an amendment that was brought to the committee by Senator Welikowski, but there's some, I guess, differences in how it was written compared to what he intended. So I'd ask Senator Welikowski to make a conceptual amendment. Senator Welikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move conceptual amendment number four.
I'll object for discussion. It's amendment number four, Senator Welikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And we had worked with legal to get this drafted just in the last few hours. Unfortunately, it didn't come out exactly how I'd like it. So I'll just make it a conceptual one. And it would be for an emergency PFD of $1,000 payable to each individual who is eligible to receive a 2020 permanent fund dividend to be appropriated from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund payable on June 15th of this year, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. That's
and that would be in the amount of $1,000.
Okay, so Senator Welikowski's put a conceptual amendment on the floor for an additional $1,000 dividend coming from the ERA earnings reserve account to be paid out June 15th to supplement the last fall's dividend. Is that correct?
It would be an emergency PFD, Mr. Chairman, and if you'd like me to give you my rationale and explain.
Yes, I would, yes.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, this is a crisis unlike any we've ever faced in our lifetimes. We have tens of thousands of Alaskans who are out of work today, right now, because of orders by the state, by government. That's not likely to end anytime soon. And we can say, well, we're going to rely on the federal government. They're going to do maybe a cash payment to people. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. The last time this happened, my staff did some very preliminary research, and it took months before the federal government could agree and before they actually issued payments to Alaskans. This would provide a payment of $1,000 out of the earnings reserve to every single man, woman, and child in Alaska who's eligible for a permanent fund dividend check this year. We've often referred to the permanent fund as the rainy day fund. Mr. Chairman, it is raining. It is pouring. Alaskans are suffering. I'm worried for the people in my district. I represent a district with many low-income, working-class people. My district are not millionaires. They don't live in $500 million houses. They're working class people who work in restaurants, they work in hotels, they work in gyms, and they are struggling to get by, and this is going to tip them over the edges. I am worried for every single constituent in my district. I'm worried for the small businesses in my district. I'm worried for the small businesses all across the state. This is a small amount. The people have given up their dividends for the last 4 years, and this is $1,000. To say we can't afford it when we're sitting on $58 billion, it's raining, Mr. Chairman. We need to do this for the people of Alaska. They need this money right now. Otherwise, you're going to see an absolute disaster in our economy. And I would urge this committee to recognize the suffering that Alaskans are going through right now, and to support this conceptual amendment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Welikowski. Senator Wilson.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I just have a clarifying question. The sponsor said that this would be payment for people eligible for 2020, and then the chair said this is a 2019 back. So I just want to make sure the eligible folks are for 2020's dividend, that applications are due this.
The chairman misspoke.
Okay.
And there's confusion.
Thank you.
Correct, Senator Welikowski?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I believe that it is better to base this off of the applicants that are from this year, which are due March 31st this year. Giving until June 15th will allow the department to process who's eligible, who's legitimately eligible for this. We shouldn't be, I don't believe, paying people from last year who might not be still living in the state, might have died. It should be based on the most recent figures that we have, which would be the applicants as of March 31st.
Okay, other comments from committee members on the conceptual amendment?
Yep.
Senator Von Imhoff and then Senator Olson.
So Senator Welikowski, please check and make sure that the governor did not extend the permanent fund dividend application period, because I believe I may have read that somewhere. and it was like for several months. So your tidy due date of March 31st may be a little squishy.
June 30.
So, Mr. Chairman.
First of application.
Senator Wilkowski.
If that's the case, if there has been an extension, I would be happy to amend this to make it for last year's.
Okay. I think it's clear on
consider
the,
that a consider that amendment of my conceptual amendment.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at some of the communities that I represent, certainly because of this, not just the statewide, but also a global crisis that we're having, this is unprecedented, and because of that, I think that as we look at the turmoil and the tumult that we're going to be enduring, it's only a matter of time before people are going to be at the end of their ropes, and the sooner we can get money out to them to try and make sure that those people that need money to go ahead and need money to go ahead and buy shells, need money to go ahead and buy gasoline so they can go out and hunt, the better it is the better it is going to be for them and the more ability for them to survive. Otherwise, I see them flocking into the cities, the metropolitan areas, and causing an even greater situation with the homeless communities that are there. With that, I speak in favor of this amendment.
Okay. Other comments from senators? Okay. I'd like to make a couple comments. Clearly, there's a need for immediate relief to our citizens all across the state. There is help coming, as Senator Wilkowski mentioned, from the federal government. Who knows when they're targeting, I think May and June. Sooner the better for the forced layoffs across the state. But in hearing the earlier presentation of our fiscal position and the position the earnings reserve is in, and the severity of this economic downturn may extend well into next year. And we need to be able to ensure that the legislature through the finance committees can respond to the needs of the citizens next year. I don't think this is going to be a 2 or 3 or 4 month issue. So with hopefully the normal dividend coming out in the fall to help fuel purchases and help the citizens get through the winter, we need to keep some ability to help our citizens if the economy doesn't bounce back quickly, which I think is doubtful, frankly. So that is why I don't support this amendment. Again, the concern of the severity of the draw on the earnings reserve and the ability and need for us to be able to assist our citizens next year. Next year's budget's going to be a lot tighter than this year. We have any other, so I'll go ahead and remove or maintain my objection to the adoption of the conceptual amendment. Clerk, call the roll.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
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 Three
yeas, four nays. Okay, Senator, conceptual amendment 4 has failed. Do we have any further amendments? On the, okay, I'd like to thank the committee, but I think we'll have a brief at ease here for a minute. Back on the record, just I want to check with the committee. We've got a couple of motions to go through to move the bill on, but does any committeeman need the committee aid to explain anything in the budget? Okay, seeing none. We have a couple of amendments. A couple of motions. Yeah, we're done with amendments they got.
Okay, so here's
a couple of motions.
That's
Senator Von Imhoff.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee direct the Divisions of Legislative Finance and Legislative Legal to make technical and conforming changes to the bill as necessary.
Any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Not the amendment, but the, okay, go ahead, Senator Von Imhoff.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee move Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for HB 205 as amended to the next Committee of Referral.
Do we have objection for moving the bill as amended to the next Committee of Referral? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill on to the next Committee of Referral. And for the information of the public, that goes to the Rules Committee. And the Rules Committee, when they feel appropriate, will have it on the floor of the Senate for full debate in second reading for consideration of additional amendments as senators may request. With that, I'd like to thank everybody for coming today and staying long, and we'll have a brief at ease before we adjourn. Brief at ease. Come back to some resemblance of order here. Everybody's getting hungry and almost a near riot. We're scheduled for a 9 a.m. Meeting tomorrow morning. We can expect that there will be a posting on the door. It'll be a delay, and the delay should not go past 1 o'clock. We have floor session tomorrow at 11 a.m. and we'll have lunch, and then So the meeting is scheduled again for 9 a.m., but it'll be postponed till 1. And we'll post that on the door tomorrow. And we'll do some bill work tomorrow afternoon. I'd like to thank everybody for coming in on Saturday. We are still expediting and full speed ahead to get ahead of this virus and get our work done. Thanks, everybody, for coming. We are adjourned.